All right. This evening I want to pretty much continue what we were doing last week, attempt to put a more personal face on slavery. But for what we're going to consider tonight, I need to do a little bit of background as to what was going on politically. As the nation progressed from the establishment of our current government in 1789, the current Constitution, until the Civil War in 1860 was, what, is that 71 years? Is that all it is? That's the period of time we're talking about to get from the Constitution to the Civil War. And a lot went on during that period of time. The main program politically was to maintain a balance between the slave states and the free states. And this was something that the South very much wanted to do, and the North was pretty much willing to do that because they realized that it was the only way they could hold the Union together. In 1820, a real crisis developed. Actually, it was in 1819. The state of Missouri, the territory of Missouri, petitioned for admission to the Union as a slave state. And, of course, this would have upset the balance of between the slave states and the free states in favor of the South. And as a result of that, Henry Clay negotiated what's called the Missouri Compromise of 1820. And under the Missouri Compromise, Missouri was admitted as a slave state, but the northern portion of Massachusetts, which I think was basically a territory at the time of the original Massachusetts, was admitted as a free state, the free state of Maine. And in conjunction with this compromise, admitting the one slave state and one free state, the portion of the Louisiana Purchase north of the 36 degree 30 minute parallel would be admitted, any future states would be admitted as free states. Now, for 30 years, things rocked along fairly well politically. I pretty much took care of things. Until 1850, as a result of the gold rush that happened in the latter part of the 1840s, the population of California really blossomed and exploded. And in 1850, California petitioned for admission as a free state. And of course, this would upset the balance, and the South was extremely disturbed over this. And so the Compromise of 1850 was effectuated, which the chief points of which were that California would be allowed in as a free state, and the slave trade would be abolished in the District of Columbia. That doesn't mean that the slaves in the District of Columbia would go free, but just no longer would they be able to be bought and sold in the District of Columbia. New Mexico and the Utah territories would hereafter be subject to what's known as popular sovereignty. That is, that it would be up to the people of the territories petitioning for admission as a state to determine whether they would be free or slave. And this suited the South because they figured they could populate those territories with slave owners. And by the time the territories were ripe for being admitted as states, they would have a majority that would petition for admission as slave states. But one of the chief bones that was thrown to the South in consideration of letting California come in as a free state, which did upset the balance, and after 1850, the balance was upset in favor of the North. One of the chief bones that was thrown to the South was a new fugitive slave law. a very, very strict and harsh fugitive slave law. And that's the fugitive slave laws are basically what we're going to be talking about tonight. Now, the next thing that happened in the mid-1850s, I think it was 1854, was the Kansas and Nebraska Act. And what brought this about was the desire of the nation as a whole, both North and South, for a railroad that would extend all the way out to the West Coast. And, of course, the South wanted the railroad to have its terminus in New Orleans and to have a southern route because it would develop lands that or territories that would most likely come in as slave states later. And the North wanted a northern route. And the chairman of the Senate Committee on Territories was Stephen Douglas from Illinois. And Douglas owned a tremendous amount of real estate in Chicago. So it was very much in his advantage to have Chicago be the terminus and have Chicago develop expand economically. So originally, in order for the railroad to go through the Kansas-Nebraska area, it had to be organized in a territory first, which it was not at the time. And in connection with that, deals had to be done with the Indian tribes. But that was all very doable. And so Douglas offered a bill that organized Nebraska as a huge territory so the railroad could go through. And the South refused to support it. And without Southern support, he could not get the bill passed. So he decided to compromise. And the compromise that he agreed to was that there would be two territories formed, Kansas and Nebraska, that they would be subject to popular sovereignty, which meant that the South could go in and try to get them admitted as slave states. But these two territories, for the most part, I mean, almost all of them, really, were in the portion of the country that was covered by the Missouri Compromise of 1820, which dictated that all future states from that area would come in as free states. So Douglas agreed, in fact, his bill explicitly revoked the Missouri Compromise of 1820. Now, this Kansas-Nebraska Act was heavily, heavily weighted in favor of the South. And the only reason that this happened, most likely, is because Douglas, who was a Northerner and did not believe in slavery, wanted to enhance the value of his real estate in Chicago. But as a result of this, the northern political scene just erupted. And the long-term result was that the old political alliances for the Whigs and the Democrats were broken up. And the Democratic Party was eventually broken up into a southern branch and a northern branch. And the Whig Party transmogrified into the Republican Party. And overnight, almost, the seeds were planted for disunion. Now, that's just a very, very rough sketch of the background to what I'm going to be reading to you. And this that I'm going to read to you tonight, and read and partly paraphrase, is part of a section from a book called The Battle Cry of Freedom by James McPherson. And it is probably the best one-volume history of the Civil War that's ever been written. McPherson starts out this chapter with this statement. On all issues but one, antebellum Southerners stood for states' rights and a weak federal government. The exception was the Fugitive Slave Law of 1850, which gave the national government more power than any other law yet passed by Congress. Now, I have to say that the way he sets this up might lead you to think that the Southerners were legally or constitutionally inconsistent. They were not. They were constitutionally very consistent, as he makes clear in what I'll read to you in a few minutes, because the Constitution explicitly provided for the return of escaped slaves that escaped into free states. McPherson goes on and says, this irony resulted from the Supreme Court decision in Prigg versus Pennsylvania in 1842. In the typical oblique language of the Constitution on slavery, Article 4, Section 2 stipulated that, quote, that any, quote, person held to service or labor in one state who escaped to another shall be delivered up on claim of the party to whom such service or labor shall be due. The Constitution did not specify how this provision should be enforced. A federal law in 1793 authorized slave owners to cross state lines to recapture their property and bring it before any local magistrate or federal court to prove ownership. This law provided the fugitive with no protection of habeas corpus, no right to trial by jury, no right to testify on his own behalf. Some Northerners believed that the law amounted to an invitation for kidnappers to seize free blacks. And indeed, professional slave catchers did not always take pains to make sure they had captured the right man, nor did every judge go out of his way to ensure that a supposed fugitive matched the description on the affidavit. A good many slave catchers did not bother to take their captured prey before a court, but simply spirited it south by the quickest route. To remedy such abuses, now we're talking about the law of 1793, to remedy such abuses, several northern states enacted personal liberty laws. These measures variously gave fugitives the rights of testimony, habeas corpus, and trial by jury, or they imposed criminal penalties for kidnapping. In the hands of anti-slavery officials, some of these laws could be used to inhibit the capture of fugitives. In 1837, Pennsylvania convicted Edward Prigg of kidnapping after he had seized a slave woman and her children and returned them to their Maryland owner. Prigg's lawyers appealed the case to the U.S. Supreme Court, which in 1842 rendered a very complex decision. It declared the Pennsylvania anti-kidnapping law of 1826 to be unconstitutional, and it upheld the fugitive slave law of 1793 and affirmed that a slaveholder's right to his property overrode any contrary state legislation. Now, I don't know enough legal history to know whether this was the first time this principle was enunciated or not, but I do know that this principle, that federal law overrides state law, is the law today and has been ever since. I don't know whether it was Prigg was the first enunciation of this or not. But anyway, it affirmed that a slaveholder's right to his property overrode any contrary state legislation. At the same time, however, the court ruled that enforcement of the Fugitive Slave Clause of the Constitution was a federal responsibility and that states need not cooperate in any way. This opened the floodgates for a new series of personal liberty laws. Nine were passed between 1842 and 1850 that prohibited the use of state facilities in the recapture of fugitives. In some areas of the North, owners could not reclaim their escaped property without the help of federal marshals. Black leaders and sympathetic whites in numerous communities formed vigilance committees to organize resistance to such efforts. These committees cooperated with the legendary Underground Railroad, which carried fugitives north toward freedom. magnified by Southerners into an enormous Yankee network of lawbreakers who stole thousands of slaves each year, the Underground Railroad was also mythologized by its Northern conductors, who related their heroic deeds to grandchildren. The true number of runaway slaves is impossible to determine. Perhaps several hundred each year made it to the North or to Canada. Few of these fugitives had escaped from the Lower South, the region that clamored loudest for a stronger fugitive slave law, and did so as a matter of principle. Northern aid to escaping slaves was an insult to Southern honor, and here's a quotation from Senator James Mason of Virginia. Although the loss of property is felt, the loss of honor is felt still more. Now, that's undoubtedly true, because the South had this sort of enshrinement of a feudal chivalry, and that matter of Southern honor was undoubtedly very strongly felt. The fugitive slave law, commented another politician, was the only measure of the compromise of 1850 calculated to secure the rights of the South. To secure these rights, and this is the law of 1850 that we mentioned earlier, to secure these rights, the law seemed to ride roughshod over the prerogatives of Northern states. Yankee senators had tried in vain to attach amendments to the bill guaranteeing alleged fugitives the rights to testify to habeas corpus and to jury trial. Southerners indignantly rejected the idea that these American birthrights applied to slaves. The Fugitive Slave Law of 1850 put the burden of proof on captured blacks, but gave them no legal power to prove their freedom. Instead, a claimant could bring an alleged fugitive before a federal commissioner, which was a new office created by law, to prove ownership by an affidavit from a slave state court or by the testimony of white witnesses. If the commissioner decided against the claimant, the commissioner would receive a fee of $5. If in favor, $10. So if he decides in favor of the slave owner, he gets $10. If he decides in favor of the slave, he gets $5. This provision, supposedly justified by the paperwork needed to remand a fugitive to the South, became notorious among abolitionists as a bribe to the commissioners. In 1850, the 1850 law also required U.S. Marshals and deputies to help slave owners capture their property and fine them $1,000 if they refused. It empowered marshals to deputize citizens on the spot to aid in seizing a fugitive and impose stiff criminal penalties on anyone who harbored a fugitive or obstructed his capture. The expenses of capturing and returning a slave were to be borne by the federal treasury. The operation of this law confirmed the impression that it was rigged in favor of claimants. The first 15 months after its passage, 84 fugitives were returned to slavery and only 5 released. During the full decade of the 1850s, 332 were returned and only 11 declared free. Nor did the law contain a statute of limitations. Some of the first fugitives returned to slavery had been longtime residents of the North. In September 1850, federal marshals arrested a black porter who had lived in New York City for 3 years and took him before a commissioner who refused to record the man's insistence that his mother was a free Negro and remanded him to his claimant owner in Baltimore. Several months later, slave catchers seized a prosperous black tailor who had resided in Poughkeepsie for many years and carried him back to South Carolina. In February 1851, agents arrested a black man in southern Indiana while his horrified wife and children looked on and returned him to an owner who claimed him as a slave who had run away 19 years earlier. A Maryland man asserted ownership of a Philadelphia woman who he said had run away 22 years previously. For good measure, he also claimed her 6 children born in Philadelphia. In this case, the commissioner found for the woman's freedom. And in the cases of the Poughkeepsie tailor and the New York porter, black and white friends raised money to buy their freedom. But most fugitives who were carried south stayed there. Anti-slavery lawyers challenged the fugitive slave law, but in 1859, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld it. Long before this, however, blacks and their white allies had done everything they could to nullify the law by flight and resistance. The quick seizures of blacks who had long lived in the North sent a wave of panic through northern Negro communities. Many black people fled to Canada, an estimated 3,000 in the last 3 months of 1850 alone. During the 1850s, the Negro population of Ontario doubled to 11,000. Some dramatic flights took place almost literally under the noses of slave catchers. In Boston lived a young couple, William and Ellen Craft, whose initial escape from slavery in Georgia 2 years earlier had become celebrated in the anti-slavery press. Light-skinned enough to pass for white, Ellen had cut her hair short, dressed in male attire, and impersonated a sickly white gentleman going north for medical treatment, accompanied by his, in quotes, servant, her husband William. They had thus traveled to freedom on real, above-ground railroads. A skilled cabinet maker, William Craft, found work in Boston. He and his wife joined the church of Theodore Parker, head of the local vigilance committee, whose congregation included several other fugitive slaves. The publicity surrounding the Crafts naturally attracted their owner's attention. As soon as the fugitive slave bill became law, he sent two agents to recapture them. This was like throwing a rubber ball against a brick wall. Boston was the communication center of abolitionism. Under the, quote, higher law doctrine, blacks and whites there had vowed to resist the fugitive slave law. Quote, "We must trample this law under our feet," said Wendell Phillips. "It is to be denounced, resisted, disobeyed," declared the local anti-slavery society. As, quote, "As moral and religious men, we cannot obey an immoral and religious statute." When the slave catchers arrived in Boston on October 25, 1850, they vowed to get the Crafts if we have to stay here to all eternity. And if there are not enough men in Massachusetts to take them, we will bring them some from the South. End of quote. As things turned out, they stayed 5 days and brought no one. Parker hid Ellen Craft in his house, where he kept a loaded revolver on his desk. William went to ground in the house of a black abolitionist who kept 2 kegs of gunpowder on his front porch and a veritable arsenal in the kitchen. Members of the Vigilance Committee put up posters around town describing the man-stealers, harassed them in the streets, and warned them on October 30 that their safety could not be assured if they remained any longer. They left on the afternoon train. President Fillmore denounced the Bostonians, threatened to send in federal troops, and assured the Craft's owner that if he wanted to try again, the government would help him with all the means which the Constitution and Congress have placed at his disposal. But the Vigilance Committee put the Crafts on a ship to England. Parker sent a defiant missive to Fillmore by way of a parting shot. This is Parker, the preacher's letter to the president. Quote, "I would rather lie all my life in jail and starve there than refuse to protect one of these parishioners of mine," the pastor told the president. "I must reverence the laws of God, come of that what will come. You cannot think that I am to stand by and see my own church carried off to slavery and do nothing." End of quote. Now, I might just add here that we have to take into account the explicit passages of Scripture, which I think is in Exodus. Well, anyway, the explicit passage of Scripture that says that you must not return an escaped slave to its owner. And I looked at that passage yesterday, and I cannot see any restrictions on it. I can't see that there's any, you know, that it's to be, according to the context, restricted to Hebrew slaves or any particular type of slaves. It's just a blanket prohibition. So, at any rate, with that type of scripture passage as their backup, you can see why these abolitionists in the North took the position that they could not return a slave to its owner and could not be complicit in such return, perhaps going to the extent of attacking the people that came to get the slave might be beyond scripture, but at any rate, you see why their attitude was what it was. Boston remained the cockpit of this new revolution. In February 1851, a black waiter who had taken the name of Shadrach when he escaped from Virginia a year earlier was seized in a Boston coffee house by agents to whom he was serving coffee. They rushed him to the federal courthouse while an angry crowd gathered outside. Denied the use of state facilities by the personal liberty law, a handful of deputy federal marshals tried to guard Shadrach. Suddenly, a group of black men broke into the courtroom, overwhelmed the marshals, and snatched Shadrach away to put him on the Underground Railroad to Canada. While Shadrach settled in Montreal, where he opened a restaurant, an uproar ensued behind him in the States. Abolitionists exulted. "This Shadrach is delivered out of his burning fiery furnace," wrote Theodore Parker. "I think it is the most noble deed done in Boston since the destruction of the tea in 1773. Well, you can see how this is kind of a one piece with the destruction of the tea. But conservative Boston papers branded the rescue an outrage, the triumph of mob law. In Washington, Daniel Webster called it treason, and Henry Clay demanded an investigation to find out whether we shall have a government of white men or black men in the cities of this country. Determined to snuff out resistance to the fugitive slave law, President Fillmore ordered the district attorney to prosecute all aiders and abettors of this flagitious offense. A grand jury indicted 4 blacks and 4 whites, but juries refused to convict them. "Massachusetts safe yet, the higher law still respected," proclaimed an anti-slavery newspaper. But a Savannah editor expressed a more common opinion, perhaps in the North as well as in the South, when he denounced Boston as a black speck on the map, disgraced by the lowest, the meanest, the blackest kind of nullification, end of quote. The federal government soon got a chance to flex its muscles in Boston. A 17-year-old slave named Thomas Sims escaped from Georgia in February 1851 and stowed away on a ship to Boston, where he too found work as a waiter. When his owner traced him, the mayor of Boston decided to allow the police to be deputized by federal marshals to cooperate in Sims' arrest. This time, officials sealed the courthouse with a heavy chain, which abolitionists publicized as a symbol of the slave power's reach into the North, and guarded it with police and soldiers. For 9 days in April 1851, Vigilance Committee lawyers vainly sought writs of habeas corpus and tried other legal maneuvers to free Sims. When the federal commissioner found for his owner, 300 armed deputies and soldiers removed him from the courthouse at 4 a.m., and marched him to the Navy Yard, where 250 U.S. soldiers waited to place him on a ship going south to slavery. Boston's mercantile elite had vindicated law and order, and for the next 3 years, no more fugitive cases arose in Boston, if only because several score vulnerable black people fled the city. The scene of resistance shifted elsewhere for a time. So far, this resistance had produced no casualties except a few cuts and bruises. Most abolitionists had traditionally counseled nonviolence. Some of them, like William Lloyd Garrison, were pacifists. But the fugitive slave law eroded the commitment to nonviolence. "The only way to make the fugitive slave law a dead letter," said black leader Frederick Douglass in October 1850, "is to make half a dozen or more dead kidnappers." Newspapers in several communities reported that, quote, "the colored people are arming." In Pittsburgh, revolvers, bowie knives, and other deadly weapons found a ready sale. In Springfield, Massachusetts, a white wool merchant named John Brown, who you've all heard of, with the glint of a biblical warrior in his eyes, organized a black self-defense group, which he named the Gileadites. It seemed only a matter of time before real blood would be shed. When the time came, the place was Christiana, a Pennsylvania village near the Maryland border, about halfway between Philadelphia and another village named Gettysburg. A Quaker community that had extended a welcome to fugitives, Christiana was anything but peaceable or friendly on September 11, 1851. That morning, a Maryland slave owner, accompanied by several relatives and three deputy marshals, came seeking two fugitives who had escaped 2 years earlier and were reported to be hiding in the house of another black man. They found the fugitives, along with 24 armed black men vowing to resist capture. Two Quakers appeared and advised the slave hunters to retreat for their own good. The owner refused, declaring that, quote, "I will have my property or go to hell." Shooting broke out. When it was over, the slave owner lay dead and his son seriously wounded. Two other whites and two blacks were lightly wounded. The blacks disappeared into the countryside. Their three leaders sped on the Underground Railroad to Canada. The Battle of Christiana became a national event. Civil War, the first blow struck, proclaimed a Lancaster, Pennsylvania newspaper. The New York Tribune pronounced the verdict of many Yankees. But for slavery, such things would not be. But for the fugitive slave law, they would not be in the free states. The conservative press took a different view of this act of insurrection that never would have taken place but for the instigations which have been applied to the ignorant and deluded blacks by the fanatics of the higher law creed. Southerners announced that unless the Christiana rioters were hung, we leave you. But if you fail in this simple act of justice, the bonds will be dissolved. This time, Fillmore called out the Marines. Together with federal marshals, they scoured the countryside and arrested more than 30 black men and half a dozen whites. The government sought extradition of the three fugitives who had escaped to Ontario, but Canadian officials refused. To show that it meant business, the administration prosecuted alleged participants not merely for resisting the fugitive slave law, but for treason. A federal grand jury so indicted 36 blacks and 5 whites. The government's case quickly degenerated into farce. The defense attorney's ridicule made the point, "Sir, did you hear it? That three harmless, non-resisting Quakers and 38 wretched, miserable, penniless Negroes armed with corn cutters, clubs, and a few muskets and headed by a miller in a felt hat, without arms, and mounted on a sorrel nag, levied war against the United States?" The government's efforts to discredit resistance produced increased sympathy for abolitionists, one of whom reported that the cause is in a very promising position just now. These treason trials have been a great windfall. After the jury acquitted the first defendant, one of the Quakers, the government dropped the remaining indictments and decided not to press other charges. Well, we're going to have to stop there, but you get the idea. They just more and more of these incidents. And you can see how the abolitionists in the North were angrier and more upset. And the Southerners in the South, the Southern slave owners, were more and more upset because of the insult to their honor by the failure of the North to live up to the Compromise of 1850 and the federal law that required the return of fugitive slaves.